For our Senate Education and Workforce Committee, I'm Senator Vicki Walker. I'm the chair. Apologize for the late delay. Most of us have committee from 1 to 3, so we need to sort of fire and reload when we get out of committee, and that's why it always is a little bit of a delay. I would like to remind you that if you have a cell phone, that you turn it on vibrate, please. And if you are new to our process and you would like to testify on any of our bills today, you'll need to sign up at one of the sign-up sheets on the table. And, committee, I'm very pleased that we can welcome Senator Jeff Cruz to the committee. He's not yet attended because he was out ill all last week. And thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Glad to see you're better. Committee, today we're going to be hearing an overview from Vicki Chamberlain, the Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. We'll have a public hearing and possible work session on what we think are the non-controversial bills, and then we'll have a public hearing on what we think might take a little more discussion. Before I bring Ms. Chamberlain up, and you'll see the staff major summaries at your station here, you'll also see a letter that I wrote to Ms. Chamberlain last Friday, which is lodging a formal complaint with the TSPC, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, to investigate the Salem-Keizer School District. The reason I did that, colleagues, if you look through your packet, you'll see the articles that appeared in the Statesman Journal about one of the teachers who was a music teacher who has pled guilty to sexually assaulting students in various degrees. I want to commend the Statesman Journal for their excellent reporting. They first reported on that case the previous weekend, and this yesterday the editorial staff wrote a very scathing editorial. I had Ms. Chamberlain in my office to ask her how administrators were regulated. They do fall under the jurisdiction of the TSPC, and she will be addressing that. And that is why I filed the complaint. As many of you know, this is a big concern of mine, as I'm sure it is of all of yours, and we will be addressing this issue in greater detail at a later hearing, but I do want Ms. Chamberlain to give some background on disciplinary action and how that will proceed, and we'll see what this committee would like to do about that in the future. So, and I also want to note that I did copy Senator Courtney and Senator Winters on this letter, but I made a slight faux pas in that I forgot about their counterparts in the House. So they have now been notified today, and I apologize for not remembering to do that last week. All right, so with that, I'd like to bring Ms. Chamberlain forward. And do you want to open it? Should we open the public hearing first? Okay, we'll hear from you first, and then we'll go into your bills when I open a public hearing. So if you want to identify yourself and give us this launch into your spiel about what you do for the state, that would be great.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Vicki Chamberlain, the Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and thank you for having us today. Before I start, I brought an overview, a report on the continuing teaching license, and then the discipline procedural information. Do you have a preference on order of receiving that?
Not really. It's whatever you feel comfortable with.
Great. With that, then I'll start with the overview of the commission so you can understand a little bit about the agency. We're the first licensure board in the nation, established in 1965, and are 100% independent of the Oregon Department of Education, although we work closely with them in partnership. California received legislation making them totally independent ahead of us one session in 1971, and so we were the second officially independent by statute licensure board in 1973. There are 12 boards like this in the nation. There are 17 members on the commission, all of whom are appointed by the governor. There are 8 educators, 4 of them from elementary and 4 of them from junior high and high school. There are 4 administrators representing elementary and junior high and representing education service districts and city schools. There's one faculty member from private higher ed and one faculty member from public higher ed. And there are three public members, one of whom must be a school board member. At least one of these 17 people also must have some experience in special education under the statute. The qualifications are that they must be serving in the positions in which they represent, except for the public members, of course, which are public by definition. The agency does not receive any general fund. It is 100% supported by licensure fees and other funds. We're small. There's about 20 people in my shop, and we will be going through the phase two of the Ways and Means budget process after they're done with the big budgets, and with some possibility, they said this time, of possibly hearing our budget and possibly passing it out at the same time. That would be exciting. There are three statutory duties fundamentally that are the mission of the agency. The primary duty is to license the educators in the state. And even though the agency is called the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, teacher stands for administrator, school counselor, school psychologist, and then the classroom, obviously instructional teacher. We discipline license holders for violations of ethics or crimes as it relates to their license or other incidents, and we approve the university programs that prepare teachers in Oregon. It may be helpful for you to know that of the new licenses that TSPC issues every year, 40% of them are prepared in Oregon. 60% come from out of state. I put a little chart on the back of the handout right here to show you and give you an idea of how the licensure breakdown has happened over the last 4 years. If you look at the top graph, you'll see that of the 6,100, and I'm looking at the far right-hand corner, year total, next to the last line, would be last year's total new licenses we issued, 6,115. Of that, roughly 2,400, just a little bit over that, were prepared in Oregon institutions, and then 3,600, almost 3,700 of them came from out of state and were prepared in programs outside of Oregon. As you can look, we did a four-year history here, and that ratios remained fairly consistent, and I think it's sometimes surprising for us. It's an indicator that our in-migration continues regardless of the economic condition of the state. I'll come back to this in a minute and talk about the bottom part. Agency has about 20 positions, and I am hired by the commission, and then we hire the remainder of the employees. I attach organizational charts if you're interested in it. And have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I think some of the statistics around how many people we license are fairly interesting. Right now, we have not quite 62,000 active headcount licensees in the state, and that would include all teachers and administrators, school counselors, and school psychologists. But of that 61,000 plus educators, only 34,600 of them are employed in the public schools. We don't have any data about who's employed in the private schools because they're not required to report that, but our information indicates it's roughly around 2,000. Of the 34,000 employed educators, 31,400 about are teachers in the classroom. That makes up 90.5% of the employed licensed educators. And then 2,590, almost 2,600 of them are administrators, and that makes up about 7.5%, which leaves our school counselors and our school psychologists at only about 1.8% of all the employed folks. So it's interesting to note, if you do the math there, that 27,000 nearly active license holders are not employed in the public schools as full-time employees. And that could be for a number of reasons. And that ratio tends to remain fairly constant over the years. Are there any questions about that part? I included for you just briefly the annual statistics about some of the workload issues. We receive about 18,000 emails a year. We have two people who answer those full time. And we receive a little over 31,000 phone calls on six lines. One of the biggest complaints about the agencies is access through the phones, and those 31,000 tend to keep those six lines fairly busy. And we have done everything we can to fix that, actually. We've added voicemail, opportunity to route out, encourage them to send an email. We have statistical information that comes up so folks know how many email are pending. We try to keep it answered every day and keep it under 50, and then our next markers like that. During the summer, it's almost impossible to stay.
Ms. Chamberlain, could you, I find that astonishing. I thought we as legislators got a lot of email, which we do, but could you give the committee an idea of what the nature of those inquiries are? Why do you get so many calls? Where are they from?
Oh, they're from everywhere. we have, we have electronic records for all of those 61,000 educators. We have electronic records for the inactive licenses, and we also have electric records for what we call friends of TSPC. And these are people who are maybe emailing from in-state or out-of-state about what it takes to get licensed, or may have a question about anything around licensure, and it actually is just mean a fair amount come in that way. They ask questions about their renewal needs. They ask questions about high quality teacher. They ask questions about adding an endorsement, moving to another license. I've answered email for a couple of days just to get a sense. It's everything. Mm-hmm. I set up on my web in the contact area, an area called Issues and Concerns. So if anyone feels that the staff isn't listening to their concerns, they can send an email to me directly that the staff can't read. So that comes into my desk directly. And that's actually been extremely helpful in helping us iron out some procedural problems we had in the office. But, you know, if you never hear about the complaints, sometimes it's a little difficult to find out what's going on. So that's actually been a very productive feature. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that does. Thank you.
On that note, I think I want to mention this. On our homepage, on our webpage, which is just like the legislative page, only it says TSPC instead of leg.state.or.us, anybody in the state can look up an active educator and find out what their license is. All you have to do is plug in their name, and what will come up, it will tell you the term of their license and what they're licensed to teach. And then that educator, if they can type in further personal information, can go in and see electronic copies of what we have received on their file or copies of letters that are in there. And we're moving to electronic exchange to help cut down on the need to get information. We tell them now what day we're processing information when it came in, like we're processing licenses received on January 15th. I'm making that up. I didn't look this morning, but that would be a for instance. So it's actually helped us a lot, but we still received over 380,000 pieces of paper last year. So I still am waiting for that paperless world, but we're not there yet.
Now, let me ask you, you mentioned that an educator can get more personal information about a teacher. Is that available to the general public also, or is that pretty limited?
Madam Chair, it is not. That's into their personal licensure file. That would have, they would have to have their birth date and their social security number, and that's information we never release.
Okay.
And it allows them access into their file. There are pieces in their file that are public information. But unless somebody had that personal information, they couldn't access the electronic file.
Okay. Thank you.
So just a few statistics. I'm going to go over these quickly because I'm going to spend quite a bit of time with you talking about our discipline procedures, about discipline. But last year we took action on 190 cases. The legislature last year funded a half-time investigator in addition to our full-time investigator, which has helped us move cases more quickly. The actions that we can take are suspension, revocation, reprimand, or probation, or no further action. We may dismiss it if enough evidence is not forthcoming. We right now have 71 cases pending. They are pending either waiting to have an administrative hearing, which happens in the Office of Administrative Hearings, or they're under investigation. Or they may be even beyond the Office of Administrative Hearings and on appeal. We only have one or two of those. And then you see there are 9 are pending in other venues, which means we're waiting for the outcome of some court case that's related to that case before we move ahead, particularly if it's a criminal case, and I'll explain that more when we get into the procedures. We had 135 new cases reported to us in 2004, and 81 of them came from school district reports, and then the remainder of them came from patrons or citizens. And that's the most common way that this information comes in our office. Occasionally, we'll receive information in a news clipping, but that's very, very rare. Generally, we've heard about it through a report. Moving on to teacher shortages, this is always an item of interest for folks, and I think the areas remain fairly constant. They are special education, music, English as a second language, or ESL, or ESOL, or ELL. I'm trying to think. There's 3 or 4 acronyms that mean generally the same thing.
And you have provided us this handy-dandy list of all the acronyms used in education.
We even came up with a couple of more for you on there. Math, library, media, science, and most second languages, these are the almost perennial shortage areas. And regardless of, I think this came up in the House Education Committee, regardless of the economic condition of the state, we tend to have shortages in this area. These are, as you know, the area that people go in to teach is self-selected. And music requires expertise. They all require expertise or some type of special inclination. The teacher preparation programs, we have 18 programs that prepare teachers, per se, in the state, and that would include the administrators, school counselors, and school psychologists. The 6 of them are public, and the other 12 are private. And it's now, if you'll look at this sheet again, I think this is interesting to note, that 57.5% of our Oregon-prepared teachers come from public institutions, and then 42.5% come from the 12 private institutions. A few of our private institutions have very small numbers, and a few of them actually produce quite a few, but sometimes that's helpful information to have. Part of our function here is to set the standards for teacher preparation and then to have site visits, regular site visits, to see that they're maintaining the standards for the programs that they asked to have approved. So they may have a elementary licensure program, a middle level, and early childhood. They may have high school subject matter. They may have an administrator program, a school counselor program. All those are subject to standards reviews on visits. Those visits, we take practicing educators and other higher ed people to make the visits, and they make recommendations to the commission about their findings upon visiting. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Stern.
Vicki, I'm pleased to see that the teachers must demonstrate competency in reading. Can we drill down there a little bit? Does that include what we've been trying to accomplish the last couple of years, and that's retraining of teachers so they understand the teaching of phonemic awareness and phonics systematically?
Excuse me. Chair Walker, Senator Starr, as you're aware, during the 2003 session, the Commission adopted the International Reading Association standards as our standards for reading programs. And that's what we would apply to the reading specialist programs. But what we did in the interim is we adopted a new elementary test with reading emphasis, and there was not a reading emphasis in our elementary test before. And how that is working, and we're just now rolling it out. The first administration is in February, and then we're going to overlap it with the existing test. But if the candidate is in an Oregon program, they will take a different test. They will take a test that does not have reading in it, because they are going to demonstrate reading competency in their teacher ed program, and we're going to work that into the assessment for completion. If they come in from out of state, then they have to take that test with reading in it. And that's a huge sea change for requirements for elementary education. We have not yet gotten to setting up standards for secondary reading literacy in the subject matter, but it is on the table to be continued as part of the completion of demanding higher standards for reading. So I'm actually very pleased with the direction we're going. And I want to comment a little bit about why we have a difference between Oregon Prepared and Out-of-State Prepared. Because many of our preparation programs are master's degree programs, our institutions use our licensure tests as admission standards. And if you have come out of an undergraduate program, let's just say that you had a history major and you've decided you wanted to teach elementary education, which could happen, you would not have had any background on being prepared to teach reading or do reading. And yet the institutions want to be assured of some success, so their admission into the programs becomes the licensure test. They made a fairly sound case to the commission that if in elementary ed there was a reading piece and the people had never had reading education, it was going to work against them. So we allowed for the programs that do use the test for admissions to select to measure reading through the program in a different manner, and the standards for that are being set up right now. So the out-of-staters, on the other hand, have completed all of their teacher preparation, and they must take the test with a reading portion in it. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I also wanted to comment that we also increased the standards for math in that test. So the top two highest emphasis for multiple subjects from pre-K through 8 are now math and reading in that test, and that was a different, that was another change. I think on the accountability piece, I just want to stress in Oregon, and we do get complaints about this from teachers from out of state, but no one's made a compelling reason why we should change it. We require basic skills testing. There are actually some educators who still cannot pass the basic skills test, and we require that. We require content in the area they're teaching. So if they're teaching multiple subjects, they have to take a multiple subjects test. Or if they're teaching a single subject, they have to take a single subjects test. And then the statute and one of the bills that you have up today also requires that they demonstrate knowledge of civil rights laws. And so they have to take that test to become licensed. And I have now talked to enough of the other programs in other states, licensure tests, and they all have their own unique requirements. There isn't a single state who will take an Oregon graduate and just license them out of the chute without having them meet their requirements too. And that's because we don't have uniform student standards. And our tests are aligned with the student standards that are adopted with the Oregon Department of Education. And this new test, this new elementary test I was just telling you about, is our first custom elementary test that's 100% aligned with the elementary content standards, pre-K through 8, that's been adopted by the Department of Ed. So we're pretty excited about that. It's a dead-on test for Oregon.
A question that came up for me when you said that we don't have uniform student standards, is that something that you would like the federal government to impose, or do you really like each state having the ability to individualize their own plans and their own testing procedures?
Madam Chair, you're asking for my personal opinion.
Well,
you probably don't want to give your personal opinion. Can you give me the flavor of thought statewide from teachers and other educators, what they like about that?
Oh, Madam Chair, I'd rather give you my personal opinion.
Okay. If that's easier, please do that.
I believe in state sovereignty for education, personally.
That's kind of what I wanted to hear
okay.
from you.
I think that probably says it all. So.
Right. All right.
Let me see. Anyway, not to read the accountability measures for you, but I think given our program approval and our discipline procedures, which I'm going to cover with you, and our standards for testing to get into licensure, Oregon has a really strong program. And I have heard from other states that people who are educated here, they love to get. They think that our institutions do a very good job. And so I'm fairly proud of the educators that Oregon has. The final page I have, not counting the flowcharts and the other graphs, it just gives you a sampling of our partnerships with the Department of Ed, the university system, and the independent colleges, which aren't part of the university system, the Oregon Education Association, COSA, for administrators, the School Boards Association, and the School Personnel Association. Mm-hmm. These folks regularly attend our meetings and regularly participate in stakeholder meetings and have regular input into our rules, and I think that they have been wonderful assistance when we say, you know, this isn't working, how are we going to make this work, and want to give them credit for investing quite a bit into the strength of the commission. That's what I've prepared for an overview before I move into the report. Do you have any questions?
I know I do. Two questions. I believe I understood from your testimony that the commission does not have jurisdiction over teachers in private schools. They're licensed teachers.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Private schools are not regulated. However, if they choose to be registered with the Department of Education, they agree to a certain number of regulations.
Okay.
But some of them require their teachers to be licensed anyway. So, for example, the Archdiocese in Portland likes to have their teachers licensed and their administrators licensed. So they work with us like a regular school district. But it is independent with each school system that's set up in the private school system. And it may be of interest to you to invite their representative in to talk to you about the private school system. His name escapes me right now, but I'll get it for you and get it to Marjorie, and he can give you a very good picture of what they do and what their expectations are and how they work together.
Okay, thank you. And then the second question I had is, we had a really fine presentation last week on cultural competency and closing the achievement gap. Can you tell me what the TSPC has been doing with regard to cultural competency issues?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can do that. The commission adopted a new goal as part of their driving goals that they do their work plan, and their goal is to adopt standards for all educators for cultural competency and into our teacher preparation programs. And we haven't begun the actual work of convening the committees to do that. But what the commission has done, given that goal, they cast a new eye now when they're looking at adopting standards. So we just adopted brand new standards for administrative licensure programs, and embedded in each one of the administrator standards now is that an expectation that the leadership of the school building and the school district will demonstrate cultural competence and will also squire the development of culturally competent buildings that are receptive to the community, the parents, the students, that help teachers lead to strategies for differentiated instruction for every student, differentiating it so that I, from wherever I am, can achieve well. And they embedded that into the standards. Additionally, they asked that model language, similarly to that, be inserted into all the new standards we're adopting for early childhood and elementary. So the next step will be working with our stakeholders to determine how we're going to measure that and how that's going to look. But the State Action for Educational Leadership Program that Pat Burke talked about last week has been extremely active, and they've been working with the Eugene School District. And the Eugene School District, with grants, has developed an assessment model for their administrators on this issue, and it's very impressive. It's only like 4 markers for evaluation, but they actually are going in to see what the administrators' influence on the buildings is, and measuring how it contributes toward closing the achievement gap for students. So we see our role in building the standards into the preparation programs and then ultimately building the standards into future licensure.
Thank you. Do members of the committee have questions? All right, then, if you want to move on to the disciplinary process.
Okay. Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to very quickly, in just a couple of minutes, do a report on the continuing teaching license that I had underneath the overview here for you.
Okay.
Last session, House Bill 2575 was passed out of the House Education and the Senate Education Committee, directing the commission to look at the continuing teaching license, which was our new licensure program, and to evaluate the problems, to listen to stakeholders, and to come up with solutions. So we convened a stakeholder summit in March. We had 80 attendees, mostly higher ed, but there were teacher representatives and administrator representatives there. And then after hearing all the input, the commission decided to make a proposal themselves, and they actually did draft a proposal and adopted rule changes. And the issues were, we had a license that had a terminal end at the end of 6 years, and then at that time, teachers were required to get a continuing teaching license. Well, the problem with that is that of our 12,000 initial teaching license right now, only 7,500 of them have jobs in school. To get a continuing teaching license, there was an expectation that they were working and completing this continuing teaching license program and then having it done at the end of 6 years. Well, this is 7,500 today. When we started on this issue 2 years ago, it was only 4,500. So my point of that is that even though we're licensing a lot of people, there are not that many of them employed in the schools. Only 2/3 of them on these new licenses are employed. So the commission solution was to make the continuing teaching license optional, to require postgraduate education for bachelor's degrees and master's degrees, and to make the master's degree not mandatory, but make education equivalent to a master's degree mandatory, which was significant. So instead of having to enroll in a master's program now, teachers who graduate with a bachelor's degree need to get 45 additional hours, 15 in content related to licensure, 15 in methodology or pedagogy classes related to licensure, and 15 of their own selective credits related to licensure. And this was a huge change because now this allows teachers who want to add endorsements to do it outside of a master's program, to add classwork for highly qualified teacher qualifications, and to design their own postgraduate work. So our stakeholders have supported the changes, and with budget support, we want to move this initial license to a 5-year license. We'll have it fully implemented in July of 2005.
That brought up, when you mentioned legislation from last session, that brought up a piece of legislation that I supported, but I'm not sure it passed, and it was allowing teacher mentoring. Do you recall that bill?
I don't recall one specifically last session.
It might have been the session before.
Okay, there was one the session before in 2001, but it didn't receive funding. And so even though they did some amendments to the bill, the Department of Ed has never been able to implement it.
Okay. So, great. I would hope that we get to that point. I think that would be a good program.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just as a side comment as I move into the disciplinary procedures information, this came up in House Ed last hour, and that is that they asked for research on nutrition for teachers, and the only thing that we know definitively is that the mentorship programs save our teachers in those first 5 years. And like all professions have some attrition, but somewhere between 35% and 40% of new teachers leave the profession within 5 years. And states have proven with invested mentorship programs, we can hang on to the, many of those teachers longer when they get support from in their district and someone to assist them and support them for the first few years. So I would encourage you, if there are any opportunities, to examine that.
Thank you. That was why I was such a big supporter of that program. I think that's true of any profession, but especially with teachers. They do a lot of hard work with our students, and they're up against a great deal of odds with low funding and large class sizes, and it's a lot of stress. So, and my son wants to be a teacher. When he gets done being a ski bum, he's 26 now. I'm hoping that'll be soon, and it's in one of your shortages in the sciences. He's a geography major, but I'm impressed that even with the way Oregon education has been, he still wants to be a teacher. But that's because there's a woman in this room, Kathy Wiper, who was an inspiration to him when he was in high school. So teachers make a big impact on children's lives in many, many ways. So thank you, Kathy, and thank you, all the teachers. Now, take it away, Vicki.
Well, Madam Chair, I came prepared at your request to talk about what TSPC does in the discipline arena. And one of the places I want to start is in the document that's dated December 21st. It looks like a list here. And it's to Oregon superintendents and principals. And it's a list of the public orders that we entered against educators in the year 2004. And the statutes require that we publish this list annually. This list goes out nationally, and so that all of the licensure agencies that I'm aware of in the nation take this information from all the states. When we receive information from the national list, we put it into our databanks, and we do a search on that list before we issue any new license, so that there's a connection there. But I just wanted to just give you an idea of, if you look, the educator is there. This is a public list, again, that we're required to do. And you'll see the actions that were taken. Their license was revoked or suspended. They may have been put on probation or reprimanded. Kind of let you flip through there. Just to give you an idea. Again, there are 35,000 employed educators, and they don't necessarily have to be employed in order for us to take action. They have to have an active license. And if they are not employed, they have to have had an active license within 5 years. That's our other jurisdictional cutoff. So, for example, just this morning we had a complaint about an educator whose license expired in 1997. We don't have any jurisdiction because now it's more than 5 years and their license is expired. However, we would keep that in the file in the event they wanted to reinstate the license and then may have some reason to follow up on it.
Now, let me ask you a question, Ms. Chamberlain. These violations and the discipline, would these things would have had to occur while they were on duty as a teacher?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, not necessarily. Okay. Most of the reported action that we receive happens on duty, but not all of the reported action. Some of it happens off duty. And for example, I think one of the best examples is there are crimes that are in the statutes, and I brought the statutes and rules, and I wanted to point out a few things to you that require mandatory revocation of licensure, and prostitution is one of them. And I would be very shocked to see that on a school ground, but I mean, the point being that, you know, that would be conduct outside of the classroom, that if anybody was prosecuted of it, we would, by law, be we can lifetime revoke their license. And in fact, we must revoke their license. There is no ability to negotiate outside those mandatory crimes. So, I mean, that may be helpful to know, too. Let's talk about the procedure a little bit and the mandatory crimes and the ethics and some of the things that happen here. We have, right on top, for the first two, three pages I gave you are the procedural rules for discipline for us and give us the grounds for discipline. And I'm not going to go over and read these for you, but I think the thing that I want to point out to you, and this is extremely important, is when we receive a complaint about somebody, we can tell the public that a complaint has been received, and then after that, we cannot talk about that case at all until it's done. If it gets to the end of the investigation and the commission decides to dismiss the case because there is not enough evidence to support the complaint, then the statute says that that information remains confidential, that the person is innocent until proven guilty. And that is actually been the subject of a couple of lawsuits with our agency. So from the moment it comes in the door and goes to investigation, it is 100% confidential. And only after the case is closed and charges have been issued against the educator and that whole process has been settled in terms that they've exhausted all their appeals if they want them, can we publish this order of this list and what it is they were charged with. So I think that's important to know. I don't think that's different than any licensure board in the state with regard to doing these type of investigations.
Now, let me stop you there, please, and ask you this. So the file is confidential. You cannot talk about it. So now I've made a complaint last Friday, so now you're not going to be able to talk to me about the specifics. But when that complaint has been processed and adjudicated, and perhaps someone is found guilty of something that would result in discipline, does that file then become public in any way, or does the file still remain confidential and we only get the information that this is the result of the investigation?
The file has never become public, but okay. The charges have become public, the facts behind the charges have become public, and the discipline becomes public. Often in these investigations, there will be medical information or other private information, and we disclose the final terminal results.
There would also be personal information about any witnesses who had spoken with investigators, names of children perhaps who had talked to investigators, and that would be very important to keep confidential as well, correct?
Yes, Chair Walker, that's exactly correct. Particularly if there's been any student contact issues, we would have names of children issues, records of interviews, that type of thing in there.
Okay. Does any member have a question yet?
Are you done?
No.
No.
I'm pausing.
Okay.
I did want to point out that piece there. So, for example, we have many cases that are in various stages that we don't publish on this list till we know it's closed and we have a final order either signed by the educator or some type of final resolution. In fact, we had to pull two names off the list when the educators filed appeals with the Court of Appeals because the statute also says that until there's a final resolution of the case, their license remains active. So even if it expires in the middle of the whole investigation, we are required by law to extend that expiration date till the whole case has been resolved.
Okay.
So just to kind of give you an idea of how that works. The if the investigation reveals that they believe there's evidence enough to support the charges, we let the educator know that we intend to recommend charging the educator at the next commission meeting. 95% of the educators are represented. All educators, teachers, administrators, everyone are represented by counsel. And if the commission charges them, they then have an opportunity to request a hearing. In 2001, the legislature took the hearing authority away from the commission and gave it to the administrative hearings mm-hmm. office. And so now, instead of hearing these things at the commission meetings, we now have to go through setting the hearings and dealing with it with the administrative law judges. The things that can happen then is the educators, through their attorneys, may negotiate a settlement with the office. This is 99% of the time this occurs with our assigned assistant attorney general, who does the negotiating with the council. And if they cannot reach a settlement, then we generally go to hearing. The hearings officer's opinion is advisory to the commission, and then the commission either accepts or rejects their opinion. And in all but one case in the last 2 years, I've seen them accept the opinion. And then when they rejected the opinion, they wrote the reasons why, and that is now on appeal.
Let me ask you this. When an educator who is charged with a crime or, let's say, a violation of the standards of conduct or the rules, and they are given an attorney, do they hire that attorney on their own, or is that something that's provided to them through their union, or how do they get counsel?
It depends on their relationship with their union and their employment.
Okay. So that's all probably collectively bargained.
Not necessarily. I mean, if they are, for example, I'll use administrators, if they're employed active members of COSA, I believe COSA assists them in their initial defense.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, let's see. So that's pretty much that process. You know, like any other licensure agency, we may get to a final order either because we've gotten there through the hearings and appeals, or we've gotten there through a negotiated settlement with the educator. Like in any other process, they have a right to appeal this to the Court of Appeals, and that doesn't happen very often. But it does postpone a little bit our speed in getting these resolved. And that's an issue that will come up, I think, a little bit when we talk about one of these bills. I wanted to go to page 3 and show you 342-143 statute. This statute is the one that says that if you look in number 2 there, I bolded some language. It says the TSPC first of all, it says that they have to be 18. And it says we may also require an applicant for teaching personnel service or administrative licensure to furnish evidence satisfactory to the commission of good moral character, mental and physical health, and such other evidence as it may deem necessary to establish the applicant's fitness to serve as a teacher. And that's where I point out teacher means administrator and everyone else. This is important because unless somebody has been convicted of one of the crimes on page 4, if you look up here under A, you see a whole bunch of numbers. But if you flip over to page, let me find it here. Here we go. Page is unnumbered. 4. So it'd be 5, 6, 7, 8. 9, 10. It'd be the 10th page, about 4 from the end. And at the bottom it says 584-020-0040. And if you flip to that next page, it defines all the numbers. And the point of that is it sort of gives you an idea of these crimes, public indecency, sexual misconduct, incest, bigamy, rapes, sodomy, and as you can see, it's primarily sexually related crimes. So this could be a conviction of a crime that occurs with an adult unrelated to teaching, but the legislature has determined that conviction of any one of these crimes results in mandatory revocation of the license, and they can never reapply unless for some reason they had it overturned. Which gets me to the part we were kind of dancing around earlier. This is why we wait for a final outcome in criminal cases. Because they may be charged with these when they're arrested, but they may not get convicted of them, and the conviction may not survive an appeal. And so it's generally useful for us to wait to the final outcome on the criminal procedure. And so that's the purpose of doing that. It saves an enormous amount of resources. And if they aren't, and if they could be charged with five of these and not convicted of any of them, and if we had revoked their license, we would have to go back and redo the whole thing. If the crime has been very, very serious and they're under arrest, they're not going to be in the classroom anyway if they're incarcerated. So we do look to that. We have the authority to make a judgment if a teacher's not in a classroom, but I have yet to see a school district that keeps teacher, meaning everyone, including administrator, I have yet to see a school district that is concerned about the child safety to keep them in the classroom if they've been charged with anything like this. So,
if they've been formally charged.
Right.
Right. And like our system of justice, the American system of justice is that you're innocent until proven guilty, and that applies to teacher discipline actions as well.
Correct, Madam Chair. Exactly. And I guess I would follow that up in saying why it's so important to keep that information confidential, because there are complaints that are frivolous in our office, and there is a fair number of them that come in frivolously, and educators are wrongfully charged in. I can't describe to you the despair that these people go through when this happens, particularly when they know that they have done nothing, and it's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, and the rest of the statutes just explain that about the list that we have to publish, and I didn't put in here our required to fingerprint, but let me talk about that for a minute before I move to the ethical rules. The statute requires that we fingerprint all educators, and we make sure those fingerprints are current within 3 years. And so if they, for example, went into, and we also, the statute also requires that we fingerprint student teachers. Or anybody going into the classroom for practicum. So if those fingerprints become colder than 3 years between when they were initially fingerprinted and they apply for licensure, we require that they become re-fingerprinted. And the reason is the fingerprints get submitted to the Oregon State Police and to the FBI. And the FBI will tell us what has been reported to them from other states. And the thing that's important to keep in mind is that not all states report their crimes to the FBI. It's not foolproof by any means. But it does catch enough that if somebody left the state and, for example, offended in Idaho or Washington or California, it may show up on an FBI report. The law enforcement data system, the Oregon data, we can get without fingerprints. We do that. So on every renewal of a license, we run a LEDS check. And if there's been an arrest in between for anything or something, that will pop up. And upon renewal of their license, educators are required to disclose whether anything new has happened. So if they don't disclose something new has happened, and then we discover that something new has happened, then they're subject to discipline for falsifying their application. So there's two things to deal with there. So there's a fairly good little circle of protection that way. With the student teachers, we check their fingerprints. If we get reports back, we clear it just like we do licensure. If we're concerned about the events, we will report it to the teacher education institution. And if it's serious, and if it's a mandatory crime, and I've actually run into two of those in the last 2 years, we have to, they didn't tell their institution when they went into the program that they had these mandatory, one was prostitution and one of them was drugs. We had to tell them that even if they completed the program, we can't give you a license. So if they were able to get it expunged from their record, which has happened one time, we could. But that has to do with the long length of time and the age of the person when it happens. So, okay. I feel like I'm kind of running around in circles here a little bit.
Well, we'll probably just go on just a little bit longer because then we need to get to our bills that you have up today. If you want to see those, get the light of day.
That would be wonderful. The last part of the big document that I gave you are the administrative rules that we promulgate under the statutes, and included in here are the ethical standards that actually are a lot of the bases, not crimes, that we receive reports for. And it can be anything from misusing school equipment under something that would be under the jurisdiction of the Government Standards of Practices mm-hmm. Commission would be an ethical violation of the TSPC standards. It could be changing a grade for an athlete. It could be making inappropriate comments or something worse ongoing with a colleague. There's just a number of ethical standards here. But I think the thing that is of interest to you is the rule that requires reporting. And it says that in our rules, we say that chief administrators must report to the TSPC when they believe that the there has been a violation of the ethics that would affect the educator standards. And as you saw from the data I gave you, most of our reports are received from school districts. And this rule was promulgated and updated in the late 90s and has resulted in a lot more efficient system of following up on incidents. The report protects the educator and the administrator, because if the educator, if there's nothing there, then the school district's done. They've done their duty, they've reported, we've investigated, it's over, and then that's a good thing. I think that's pretty much it on the procedure, Madam Chair. Did you have any other questions?
Senator Decker, do you have, do you still have that question?
Just on your opening, the thing that struck out to me, Vicki, out of all the entire presentation was the mentoring statistic. And I don't know if it's a funding issue, but the very fact that I was looking at the years, in 2003, 2004 was our lowest number for both Oregon University system and then the private system's production of teachers, and then the attrition rate that happens within the first 5 years. It seems to me that we ought to have a more bold effort in terms of, if the mentoring is that effective, it just seems to me that should be priority number one, both at TSPC, certainly here, because the savings that would occur if you actually retain that degree of teachers. And so my only encouragement to you would be, and it's an encouragement to myself also, is to really, if those statistics are accurate, is that we should really put those out there, because that's just a huge savings if you're able to retain that percentage of teachers that we're losing in the first 5 years. And I think both now for this committee and for when TSPC is before the public and doing presentations, my only 2 cents would be to just highlight that and really hammer that if the legislature, because of fiscal realities, doesn't fund it, then school districts should just do it. And we should have a model program that might assist.
Chair Walker and Senator Deckard, we have I think a great design in the statutes and administrative rules of the Department of Ed, because there was a lot of energy behind this in the 90s and early 2000s. And the funding never would have reached everyone. The big districts actually have done a pretty good job, a lot of them, of doing their own mentor programs, like you said. Some of the districts are so small, it's almost an impossibility. I mean, if you have a teacher teaching two grades, you wouldn't have anyone there to mentor them. So I don't have a good answer for this, but it's one of the few things that we have great research on that proves that it works. And so part of, in just response to what you're saying, of the leanings in the new administrator standards is exactly that. It's your duty as a leader of the district and the building to help support these new educators and set up systems to do that, even if you don't have a lot of money. So we're hoping that'll help move in that direction. So I agree with you.
Madam Chair, just on that, if there's things that we ought to do, Vicki, that strengthen, I hate to use the word mandate, but I won't use the M word, but other things that we can help out, I think we ought to.
Madam Chair, Senator Deckard, I think my colleagues at Oregon Education Association have done a lot of research in this area and have some good data for you and some good ideas.
Well, it's handy that I happen to sit on the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, but unless it's been requested in someone's budget, we can't really even argue the issue, but I will do my best. Thank you. Okay, if there's no further questions, then I think what we're going to do is open a public hearing, and I need you to stay right there, Ms. Chamberlain, because I'm going to have you go through all the bills.
Okay.
So let me open a public hearing on Senate Bill 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, and 52, which are all the bills we have up today. What I would like you to do, Ms. Chamberlain, is just go through all of the bills and give us a brief summary about what they do, and then we will take them one by one for public testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Great. I will run through each one of them and tell you why we propose introduction of the legislation. The first bill, Senate Bill 46, does two things. It takes out language in, if you'll look at line 7 and 8 of the bill, where it says, failure to obtain the first aid card shall result in suspension of the teaching license. Well, this seemed a pretty onerous requirement, and it hasn't happened in our shop in actual practice in quite some time. In fact, I think in over 15 years, and I've been here nearly three. It's a redundant statute. The statutes require in ORS and another statute in 342.169, it says that the state board shall establish a rule to require school districts to make sure that there is a certain ratio of first aid card holders in a school district per students, and this is something that should be monitored through school district standards and that type of review rather than a licensure requirement. It's been we do tell them that they have to have within 90 days of getting their license per the statute, they're supposed to have a first aid card, but we generally leave it up to the district under the other statute to enforce that. So this amendment would just require them to get it for licensure if their district required it of them. So that was that proposal. It was to put into practice what we were doing.
And we have no one else signed up to testify on that bill, so that one is non-controversial, I can assume. If you want to move on to 47.
Okay, Senate Bill 47 isn't quite as easy to explain, but in essence, when the commission was holding all of our own hearings, all discipline-related hearings, this statute suspended us from being required from following all of the Administrative Procedures Act's rules, which govern evidence and hearing procedures, and I think the intent was to leave as much flexibility as possible with the commission. We would like to have that repealed because there are actually protections not only for the educators in those rules, but also for the commission. In other words, we would have more flexibility in terms of instead of having just depositions, we could gather evidence in other less expensive ways. And it has come to our attention that this isn't a useful rule or statute anymore now that all of our hearings are going to the hearings officer panel, and we can't invoke a rule under the Administrative Procedures Act because we have this statute. So I can't pick one glorious APA rule that we really want to have, other than I know we ran into an evidence issue, and the AG recommended that we repeal this statute.
All right. And again, there's no questions from the committee, and there are no persons signed up to testify on that bill as well. Move to 48.
Senate Bill 48 is a housekeeping bill for us, but it also has one very serious piece, and I did get to have a conversation by conference call today with some tribal representatives at the Oregon Department of Education, and it's the issue that leaps out in the summary language of the bill. But as I was explaining in our report, and I maybe glossed over this, I'm not even sure I said it, but one of the features of our changes, we want to move our three-year licenses to five-year licenses. And the American Indian Languages license was the only license in the statute that was locked into 3 years, and it wouldn't allow us to change it to 5 years like the other regular licenses that we issue. So the amendment in there is to take out the 3 years and allow the commission to set it by rule so that these can be consistent with other licenses. And I did explain that to the tribes. The second thing that this bill does, and it does it on page 2, is that the legislature, and it's on lines 19 and 20, the legislature made a mechanism a few years ago that allows TSPC to expedite a license out for somebody in a hurry, because sometimes it can take a while in the summertime to evaluate licenses. But the statutory language says that, it says on line 19, within 2 working days after receiving a completed, and we added, and qualified application, the commission shall issue an emergency license. And sometimes the fingerprints come back, sometimes anything comes back, sometimes their credentials aren't complete, and we didn't think it was strong enough. So we want to, on first review, make sure the candidate's qualified before we put them in the classroom.
And what page number?
This page 19? 2, lines 19.
Okay, thank you.
And on section 2 there of the bill, we changed, that's housekeeping, the spelling of endorsement. And then another related issue on, related to the fees on page 3, and that is on lines 17 through 20, is that the way the statute was written, only school districts could request expedited service, and that was actually honored to the letter in our shop, because it says only school districts may ask for it, and or an ESD, and we have added, taken that language out and allowed the applicant to do it. What we have is we have teachers occasionally who want to go teach overseas, and they have an application and an interview, and they need something back right away so that they can take this job, and we didn't want to violate the statute. So this allows any educator who wants to expedite their license, rightfully so, to request that that happen. They don't need to have a district to do it. Let's see, the changes on line 37 are housekeeping, change in spelling, and then on the next page, on page 4, on line 8, is also housekeeping. The American Indian language issue that I was explaining to you is contained here in section 5. I'm trying to locate where we took it out.
Page 5, line 13. Page 5, line 13, according to our handy-dandy committee administrator.
Oh, page 5. I'm reading page 4.
Yeah.
Page there 5. It is. Thank you. That's it. Shall be valid for 3 years. That allows us then to set the license for 5 years and makes it prospectively effective. And then in section 8, this is another issue. This statute here, this is the one I showed you earlier in the discipline statute that requires us to do our annual list. But it also requires us to include teachers who have been had their license suspended because they gave less than 60 days notice to the district. Well, that seems very pretty onerous to put you on a national discipline list because you have had your license suspended under that provision, and a bill coming up here will address that. But even if we didn't reach agreement with our stakeholders who opposed the bill to repeal that statute, I have had some conversations with them. We think it's only fair they not be included on the discipline list if their license is suspended for failure to give a notice when they retired.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Why? Thank you, Ms. If a teacher is in a small district and doesn't give notice and quits and goes somewhere else and he's not disciplined, don't you think small districts should need to have that protection? Ought to hire, or at least know that he didn't give notice? Put that small district in a bind when he left?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the reasons that teachers leave districts are myriad. They aren't always capricious decisions. Sometimes the majority of our teachers are women, and sometimes their mates move, and that's happened often, and it's too expensive for them to maintain two households. And there are many situations like that. So that's a policy decision for you to make, and that actually happens to be the conundrum. These are issues that can be negotiated in the collective bargaining agreement, but it doesn't seem to rise to the level of the other disciplinary issues all the time. And we don't make findings of fact around their reasons for leaving. The statute's just rock solid clear. If they leave without 60 days, we shall suspend, and there's no leeway for reasons if the district reports them.
And Senator Morissette, I think in Senate Bill 52, you could probably the merits of that, but I think what she's getting at is that it doesn't rise to the level of putting it on this national list that you saw earlier.
Well, I disagree.
But you disagree with that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Anything else on Senate Bill 48 from you, Ms. Chamberlain?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. We did have someone signed up to testify. We'll take all other testimony after you finish your presentation on all your bills.
Great.
So if you'll move to 49.
Okay. Senate Bill 49 arose out of the commission's taking on the task of assisting in defining highly qualified teacher, and this turned out to be file evaluations that were extensively labor-intensive because the way the federal law is defined, we had to do transcript evaluations. My point of that is our statutory fee schedule is so narrow, there wasn't a fee I could plug that activity into. So what we did is we charged them for the cost of the duplicate license, which was $10. We've done over 2,000 of those evaluations, and it did cause us to backlog our other processing of licenses a couple of times. This is not to say that we would create a fee that would be equivalent to applying for a full license, but we also weren't able to generate enough money to hire temporary help to assist us in that workload. So the language would give us the ability to set a fee when something like this comes up that's reasonable. There's other language in there that says we're not to set fees that don't cover the cost, and yet our fees are to cover the cost, and this would allow us to do that.
Okay. And likewise, we have someone signed up to testify on that. Actually, two people, so we'll hear from them a bit later. So we can move on to Senate Bill 50.
Okay. Senate Bill 50, Madam Chair, is a bill that modifies our existing statute that requires the testing for civil rights knowledge, and that's been modified to include all civil rights laws. When this was drafted in the 70s, it mentioned the only two that were in existence then, and now there are over a dozen state, local, and federal laws. In addition, we added language that we would establish the cultural competency standards for teacher licensure, and It's what we believe was the intent of the Civil Rights Knowledge Statute in the first place, is that teachers would have knowledge of anti-discrimination laws and then would apply it accordingly. But this is a proposal to get the support to do this prospectively.
I have a question about that, because you testified earlier that the commission had made a choice to try to move forward on this issue. Do you need this bill to continue that work?
Madam Chair, we do not.
Okay. All right. And likewise, we have someone signed up to testify on that bill. You're not batting 1,000 here, Ms. Chamberlain, but that's okay. The next one, I think we're going to do fine. So Senate Bill 51.
Senate Bill 51, TSPC has a statute that says that we're required to find school districts whenever educators are misassigned, and there's a extensive language about the procedures that you go through to do this, and this statute likewise has not been invoked for many years, maybe one time in the last 15 years. It's not a great time to be taking money from school districts, and my experiences in exploring this with districts and educators is that 99% of it is inadvertence, and it's actually become way better with our electronic licensure system and information, because the district can get online instantly and know clearly what the educator's licensure is. We were reviewing our statutes, and here's one that we're not actively invoking, and the language would allow us to pursue egregious violations with educators, and that's what we've done. If right now the district or the administrator will prove their inadvertence, and it's almost always inadvertence, but occasionally we had one case where an educator taught for 8 months, the administration hadn't caught it, and the educator knew it, and they didn't want to report something on their license, and we discipline them. But in the 3 years I've been there, there's been two cases at the most under this. But it allows us in good faith not to invoke the penalty on the district and to pursue we've actually had at least one administrator who didn't think licensure laws needed to be obeyed, and then that would help. This would help with that situation.
Ms. Chamberlain, we just come up here to pass laws because we think it's fun.
I know.
At least some have that impression, but generally we pass laws because we think it serves the public well. So, all right, the last one is Senate Bill 52, and there is someone
yes.
signed up to testify on that as well.
Right. Senate Bill 52 was submitted to the governor's office with the full acknowledgement of the opposition from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and the Oregon School Boards Association, and there are lots of people to make pros and cons arguments about this bill, but the idea was to repeal the 60-day notice rule because it could be negotiated in a collective bargaining agreement. The issue that has happened, though, and this is I think the reason, not I think, I know why we propose it, is that now that the commission is required to submit all of their issues to the hearings officer panel, the last three cases that we've had of this, if the educator left at the beginning of the year, we were unable to get a hearing on it until April or May, and it says it's suspended till the end of the school year. So we suspended a license for 2 weeks because the law says it has to remain active until we get a final outcome, and then in the most recent case we suspended, and it's just a fact finding. Did you leave without 60 days notice? Our authority to do that in-house was taken away when the hearings panel was started. So we now, the last one was 6 weeks that they suspended the license. It costs us almost $3,000 a case to do these by the time we pay the hearing officer, TSPC, who has nothing to do with these cases, by the time we pay our attorney general's costs and our hearing officer panel costs. So as a matter of resource savings, we propose to repeal it, but you're going to hear other testimony.
I have heard other testimony in my office, but we would like to hear it here in front of the committee. So that completes all the bills we have from your department, Ms. Chamberlain. I'm going to ask you to step back and thank you very much for being here today and offering your testimony and your overview. We appreciate it. And the first bill that we had any testimony, any person signed up to testify was Senate Bill 48. So I believe we have Beth Ann Darby with OEA signed up for that. If you state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Education Association. And I just quickly wanted to let you know that OEA supports Senate Bill 48 for the reasons outlined by Ms. Chamberlain. We were very active in many of these discussions in other years around the American Indian teaching license, and we think it's very appropriate for the statutory time period to be set by TSPC and to align it with their other licenses. And I would also note that we do support the additional change of removing the language that requires the suspensions for these 60-day violations to go on the national disciplinary list.
Oh, that was Senate Bill 52.
There's a piece of the language
in
Senate Bill 48.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, great.
I've also signed up for the next two.
I know you have.
Okay.
And just if you want to just stay right there, because I have Bill Beck from COSA who signed up to testify on 49 and 50 also, so the both of you can be there at the same time. So is Bill Beck in the room?
Madam Chair, I won't take the committee's time. I just want to.
I'm sorry, you have to. We're all on audio here and visual and everything else, so we need you to state your name and your affiliation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Beck, Director of Professional Development for Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I also serve as the liaison to TSPC in that role.
Okay, and you wanted to say what to us? You were
COSA,
signed up to testify in 49 and 50.
Eagerly supports the passage of Senate Bill 49. On Senate Bill 50, if you'd like me to speak to that now.
Actually, let's wait a second. Ms. Darby?
Sure, Beth Ann Darby with OEA. And the only reason why I wanted to testify on Senate Bill 49 is to let you know that we very much support its passage and that we worked very hard with TSPC and COSA to come to this agreement. And it's probably of the package, it would be our priority to help make that work.
Okay, I'd love to hear that when you work together. Members, that has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It does not. We need to add that. We need clarification from. Oh, Ms. Chamberlain, are you still here? I need to put my glasses back on. We've been told, you want to come forward? We've been told that Senate Bill 49 needs a referral to Ways and Means. Do you have an objection to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no. We have no objection. We do need the P-bill on Ways and Means.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, so that takes care of Senate Bill 49. So Senate Bill 50, the two of you, Ms. Darby and Mr. Beck, have signed up for that one as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Beth Ann Darby for OEA, Oregon Education Association, and just expressing support. We think that giving TSPC the rulemaking authority on cultural competency standards really allows all stakeholders to be a part of the process and to ensure that local issues are also addressed, and we really think that that's the right way to handle this issue, is to let it be dealt with at TSPC through their rulemaking process.
Okay. Mr. Beck?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bill Beck with COSA. COSA has spent a lot of time and a lot of conversation about cultural competence. Matter of fact, we devoted our annual convention last June to that. We brought in Samuel Betanzas, who's a international consultant in the area, Donna Beagle on issues of dealing with children of poverty, and then Senator Abel Gordley was also a keynote speaker. We feel strongly that we need to move forward with this concept. COSA, ODE, and an OEA, a number of other folks have been working, not OEA, but OSBA and OSPA have worked together to formulate a set of standards for administrators. Each one of those standards, as Vicki said, has embedded in, within them statements about the need for cultural competence. We believe the same thing ought to happen for teachers, and having that a part of the teacher education program really will sustain a long-term focus on a critical issue. So we fully support this bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Senator Decker?
Thank you. So the thing that I'm wrestling with, I appreciate the testimony, is how, after going through just a few sessions on cultural competency, how a civil rights test of being able to name civil rights legislation would ever make me a better imparter of knowledge or a better, more culturally competent educator. The fact that I could recite major events in history around civil rights seems, I mean, diversifying the teaching corps would be a great first step, and maybe that's where we should put our energy, but just in the prior testimony, hearing that was, please.
Chair Walker, Senator Deckert, Beth Ann Darby with OEA. And just to clarify what the bill does, what it allows TSPC to do is to set standards for licensure around cultural competency. OEA has been very involved with creating modules on cultural competency to localize cultural competency training. And what this will do is help TSPC to adopt some of those programs and other like programs into licensing standards and continuing license standards, so part of the continuing licensure process. So it will turn into more than just the civil rights test is the bottom line. It'll really hopefully be able to address local cultural issues and the diversity that we have in our state of Oregon.
So yeah, then what would be an example of a local program? And I don't know what the genesis of the civil rights test was, and perhaps, I mean, that's just my first blush, that's not really going to get you a culturally competent. I'm not sure if it would help me if I was, but what was the genesis of that? And then what is a good example of a local cultural competent, if we're going to punt this to TSPC to help design locally, what would be a good example of how that would manifest itself?
Madam Chair, Senator Decker, if I may, I believe the history on the what you're referring to is out of Title IX, and it goes back to when that act was passed, that we had a requirement within education, within this state, to make certain that we have a speakable knowledge about, you know, what that act entails. And it is a very small attempt. It was a half a day, sometimes a full day, and sometimes even less than that. So that's a very, very different issue, unless I'm misunderstanding you. What we're looking at doing is having a set of standards that the universities would have to address within their teacher preparation program. The standards that were just adopted by Teacher Standard and Practices Commission at their last January meeting requires the institutions, there are seven, soon to be nine, institutions to address each of those standards within their preparation program for administrators. So that would be the parallel. And there'd be a good deal more than what we have seen in the past under Title IX workshops or anti-discrimination, as they're called now.
Okay, I don't see any other questions on Senate Bill 50. Senate Bill 52, we need to ask Jim Green to join us at the table also. You two need to stay there. And I'd like to remind you, I don't have the pink pig that you put money into if you use acronyms, but please at least once define the acronym that you use so that our listening audience knows what the heck we're talking about. So, Mr. Green, if you would identify yourself and who you represent by the full name of your association, that would be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association.
Thank you. And since you're new at the table, I'll let you start.
Senate Bill 52, if you take a look at it, looks somewhat innocuous at first, but if you turn the bill over to the last page 4, line 3, it repeals a section of statute, and that's what this bill does. And what it repeals is the requirement that a licensed teacher, either in an elementary or secondary school, give 60-day notice to the superintendent that they are leaving that job. And I think Ms. Chamberlain explained to you some of the difficulties that TSPC has had with that, with the hearings officer bill that passed, I believe, in the 2001 session. And if it's a resource issue with TSPC, I'm willing to work on this bill so that, you know, a teacher whose spouse is moving away and they legitimately can't keep a second household, we don't want to suspend that teacher's license. They have a legitimate reason that they need to leave, and maybe we need to amend this bill to allow TSPC to take those into consideration. But where you have a small district and you have a teacher that's a foreign language teacher, a music teacher, a special ed teacher, who are very hard to come by, and you have a large district who offers them a significant amount more money across the state, but that small district has already done their hiring, they've already set their plan for the next year, and the teacher just up and leaves. This bill was passed back in 1975 to create this statute that had some tools there for management to say, wait a second, we've got a contract here and we need to talk about that. Remember, this is not mandatory for the district to go to TSPC. It's at the district's discretion whether they tell TSPC. So some of the cases where a spouse moves may be taken care of at the local level between the teacher and the administrator or in a collective bargaining agreement. But we can't support the total repeal of this legislation. We're willing to work on amendments to make it work for TSPC, let TSPC have some discretion back that. But in small districts, if you don't have this type of tool, it can really decimate a program. And in those areas of teacher shortages across the state, this could really, really hurt and be detrimental to small school districts and their staffing patterns.
Okay,
I'd be happy to answer any
questions. I have a question for you, because I'm not clear. You indicate that teachers can work it out with their local school district, local administration, and it doesn't have to be reported to the Teacher Standard Practices Commission. Is that not required under the statute that be reported?
Madam Chair, and maybe Ms. Chamberlain can correct me, but as I look at the statute, the district does not need to report those to TSPC.
And Ms. Chamberlain gave me the okay that you are telling me the correct thing. So that was going to be my next question. What if someone's parent died in another state and suddenly they need to go and take care of them? That could be negotiated at the district level by saying, here's the hardship that I have. I got to leave.
And Madam Chair, we would encourage that at the local level. And in addition, as I said, if the problem is a resource at TSPC because they have to use this hearing officer panel,
mm-hmm.
let's put the discretion back with TSPC to take a look at those cases. Because what the statute was originally passed for was to stop a teacher, you know, 4 days before class is going to start and say, I got a better job offer from another district. In cases, at least my belief would be, in cases where, you know, something like the circumstance you speak about or where a spouse moves, I think those are worked out at the local level, and they should be worked out at the local level, and we probably shouldn't suspend those teachers' licenses. But when they just leave because they got a better offer, I think we need to have some tools in there so that for personnel management and human resource, we know that we've got people in the classroom in those small school districts. This is really a particular issue for small school districts.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Darby?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Beth Van Darby with the Oregon Education Association, and we would support the bill as drafted, but we would certainly be willing to work on amendments to help its passage. I think our primary concern is with the national disciplinary list, and especially in these cases, hardship cases, it just seems that it's a bit much for something that maybe was not in the members' control, and so we would very much appreciate the opportunity to work on amendments to make it a bill that can pass.
Okay, and Mr. Beck?
Madam Chair, Bill Beck with Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, members of the committee. Our concern is taking the rule away entirely leaves a void with no recourse. And in our opinion, just based on the number of incidents that TSPC has had to deal with and the number of teachers out there and all of the possibilities that exist for late notice to districts and so on, this has not been abused by administrators in terms of every time this occurs, they report to TSPC and demand licenses be revoked or suspended.
Would you object to not having it go on the national disciplinary list?
No.
Okay. Senator Morissette had a question?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess if you're going to modify
the TSCP's authority for, well, if you're going to modify Senate Bill 252, I think you should modify Senate Bill 48. And if a teacher does leave in violation of a contract that is not amenable to the district, I think that should go on the list. I mean, I don't want to take an egregious offense off of the national list. So if you can separate the reasons for people leaving, you know, can take care, you can mitigate the harm done to cases where it's essential for them to leave, but still keep the penalties for the case that Mr. Green described. That should be on a list that so other people understand what was, you know, what the reason was. So I would recommend that you modify Senate Bill 48 if you're going to modify 52.
Do either of you want to respond to the senator's concerns?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm willing to work with Ms. Chamberlain and Ms. Darby and Mr. Beck on any amendments to make these issues work and whatever the committee wants to do with it. But I think we need to be sure that some tool is there. Okay. Repeal of this isn't going to work for our small school districts, and I will make myself available to a work group or your committee administrator to help with that.
All right. Well, what I think I'd like to do, Senate Bill 52 is not up for work session anyway, is ask you to work on that. And I'm going to hold back Senate Bill 48 also to address Senator Morissette's concerns. And we'll hear back from you on that. So if there are no more folks to testify, then I'm going to close the public hearings and then we're going to go into some work sessions. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 46 through 52. And I will open a work session, colleagues, on Senate Bill 46. We had no testimony in opposition to that, and none of you expressed any concerns, so I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 46 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 46 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, we can call the roll individually, or if there's no objection, we can just gavel it down. Any objection? None? Okay. Close the work session on Senate Bill 46, and who would like to carry the first bill of our committee? You know, the neat thing about being chair is I don't have to carry any of them.
That's true, unless you want to.
No, you know, I carried the most bills last session of any senator, so I'm not in a hurry this session to match that. So, Senator Cruz, let's start with you. You're the new guy.
Okay.
All right.
Seniority has merit.
I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 47. Again, colleagues, we had no testimony in opposition, and you all seem fine with that, so I'll entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 47 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 47 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, that bill passes. I'll close a work session, and we'll just move left to right. Senator Deckert, how would you like to carry that one? Thank you. As I indicated, Senate Bill 48, we are going to hold back. Senate Bill 49 needs to go to Ways and Means, so if someone would like to make that appropriate motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 49.
Oh, excuse me. I have to open a work session on Senate Bill 49 first. Now I'll entertain a motion.
I move Senate Bill 49 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 49 to Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Hearing none, that bill moves forward, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 49. The remaining part of our agenda is not scheduled for work session, so we'll bring those back at a later time. I'd like to thank everyone for coming today, and I'd like to especially thank and recognize the Oregon Education Association members who are throughout the audience today, and we appreciate your dedication and service to the state of Oregon, and hopefully we'll see you later this evening. And if there are no other issues before the committee, we are adjourned, and we'll see you Wednesday afternoon. Yeah.